Okay, and the mics are back on. Rihanna?
So the EV car.
You're going to talk to us about IFRS 9?
Yes. Do I need to ring the bell?
Yeah. Robert?
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 Radford?
I apologize.
Okay, Rihanna, the floor is yours now.
Right, so the exposure draft. It's the classification and measurement exposure draft on IFRS 9. And so this exposure draft is part of the overall project to replace IAS 39, which is the main accounting standard for the recognition and measurement of financial instruments. And we've had a preliminary discussions of these proposals back in June last year when at the joint GPF and CMAC meeting. So we don't plan to go over all of these proposals again, but just to focus on the main ones. Now, this exposure draft only proposes narrow scope amendments to the classification and measurement requirements in IFRS 9. And that's because the ISB believes that IFRS 9 is fundamentally sound, and that when you classify financial instruments using a basis that provides information on the cash flows, the future cash flows to the users of financial instrument or financial statements is the right one. And this exposure draft does not fundamentally change those concepts. So in a nutshell, what the exposure draft aims to do is to reaffirm those principles, apply a bit more or clarify the application guidance on how to apply those principles, and then importantly introduce the fair value through other comprehensive income measurement category for debt instruments. Now, the agenda paper we've sent mainly focus on this last proposal, so the introduction of fair value through OCI. And on page 2 of the agenda paper, we've illustrated the structure of the classification and measurement requirements in IFRS 9 using the principle-based approach. And the main two criteria in which that is being done is whether the contractual cash flows are solely payments of principal and interest, and the business model within which the assets are being managed. Now, as you can see from that illustration, the exposure draft builds on that structure. So an entity is still required to assess the contractual cash flows of the asset and the business model within which it's being managed to determine how to account for them. And I think that begs the question as to why are we changing IFRS 9 if we think it's so great. The main reason for the fair value through OCI introduction, one of the main reasons is we've received feedback that just having two business models, so just having the amortized cost and the fair value through profit or loss business models, is sometimes too limiting. And when an entity has assets that they are managing both with the objective to collect contractual cash flows, but also to sell those assets, requiring measurement at fair value through profit or loss is not appropriate, and that fair value information in isolation for those assets does not give you all the appropriate information you need for them. So we are therefore proposing this fair value through OCI measurement category. And, you know, similar to the assets that held at amortized cost, you would first need to assess your contractual cash flow characteristics, so whether they're still simple cash flows, and then whether it fits this business model criteria. And because the assets are being held both to collect contractual cash flows and to sell, both fair value information and amortized cost information is relevant to judge the performance of the portfolio. So it's integral to the performance of this business model. So this measurement or the proposals results in both sets of information being provided. To the extent that the profit and loss profile for fair value OCI looks exactly the same as it would for amortized costs. So you've got the same interest measurement, you've got the same impairment, and recognizing the gains and losses on the sale of the assets, whereas the balance sheet will reflect the fair value of the assets. And I think with that, I've now said my bit, so I'll hand over to you to get your questions. So in the agenda paper, I think we have two questions on fair value of OCI, and I'm happy to take both of those questions at the same time.
Do you want to say what they were?
So the first question we ask whether you think it is appropriate to measure simple debt instruments at fair value through OCI if they are managed both to collect contractual cash flows and for sale. And then the second question is whether you think both amortized cost and fair value information is relevant for these debt instruments, and it should be provided in the primary statements instead of just no disclosures.
Okay, opening it to the floor.
I can add a short one. I recommend reading the dissenting opinions from me and Steve Cooper.
Are you agreeing with each other in your dissent?
Absolutely.
That's interesting.
We really liked going down from four categories to two, and so we regret the reinvention of AFS. And it just really doesn't seem beyond the wit of man to say, you know, does it look more like it's being held to collect, or does it look more like it's being held to trade, really? And what's slightly weird about this, is with it being insurers who are upbeat, is up in arms, they're never upbeat, are they? Is that, you know, insurers, as we've sort of been seeing, the heavy lifting in the analysis is of their balance sheets. You know, if it's fair value through the balance sheets, they're going to get the volatility anyway. Or are they saying they're not? Are they saying that in the balance sheet that somehow they're so wonderfully matched that net assets are sort of not volatile, and that this is somehow introducing some accounting volatility into the P&L? I'm still not quite convinced about what their real motives are.
I think the concern is around representing volatility in the income statement. So they are comfortable that they get analysed on a fair value basis on the balance sheet, and that that's used as a way to project the future. But they want to remove the volatility from the income statement, is my understanding of their issue there.
Presumably there's economic volatility. If they're thinking of selling them, I don't know. There ought to be some way of just sticking them either in one or the other.
Jane, can I take a step back? So I wanted to ask about that. When you initially talked about the two different classifications, were you talking about them? Do you believe that the third classification would be too difficult to operationalize? Is that what you're saying? Or that you just think that every asset should actually be able to fit into one or the other?
The latter. Okay. And therefore a sort of related suspicion that it's going to be quite fudgy, this reinvention of available for sale, which we applauded getting rid of.
Thanks. Robert.
Okay. Last week, Pat Finnegan did a reasonably good job of explaining why you actually might want to do this. And so...
Is that an investor letter that I haven't read?
No, it was a verbal conversation. Oh. But so with due respect to those board members that think this might be a good idea, I hear you. The ISB has forgotten that we all made a mistake at IS 39. David Tweedy said, if you understand it, read it again. And I think that's a very good comment. It is incredibly difficult. There were too many categories. The boundaries between the categories were too soft. At the time we were reading this thing, and by the way, I don't know when I started reading financial standards as sort of to help in the process of users, but that is actually where I started. So you can go figure out when that was a just exposure draft, and that is my starting date. We were very concerned as users at the time that there were too many categories, it was too complex. We were very concerned about the boundary issues, but we finally got our heads around that there were enough safeguards and that they were robust again. I'm hearing all the same words. We really do need the categories. The boundaries are safe. It's robust. What we're forgetting is when the financial crisis happened, in no uncertain terms, the banks got the regulators to get the financial standard setters, plural in the world, to help banks hide losses. That's the issue. This is because banks want it. They want to have their cake and they want to eat it. Now, it's not sufficient just to complain. You have to come up with an answer. It would be much better if you could just keep two categories and figure out how to make two categories work. I don't think you've done a good enough job. But If you must go with three categories, what you need to do is you need to basically force the FASB and the ISB standards to be so that you can go from one to the other. And you need to throw in enough required disclosures so that when the banks go after another reclassification game, that it's going to automatically pop out in the financial statements that in fact what they're trying to do is to hide losses. And there was this great, because the FASB is allowed to reclassify, I forget which one it was. It was under the Europeans, under IFRS, there was some ability to reclassify. The FASB said, well, the U.S. banks went to the FASB and said, we have to be able to reclassify. And then, of course, since the Americans were now reclassifying, there was some question about whether the ISB should change the standards. And those two standards that were written to be exactly the same, they should have been exactly the same. So if you must go down this route, miles of disclosure so that the gaming will become apparent, because they are going to game this.
There is an awful lot of disclosure in there about reclassifications right now, including how you treat profits and losses and how you show it. Do you think that's not miles enough? Or is it more a case of this is still out there and being discussed, so it's not necessarily clear what it's going to be?
I haven't read all of the disclosures. I may have an excuse to... This thing keeps changing so fast that in fairness, you know. Yeah. But I suspect, I would be surprised if the disclosure was adequate on a 2 model, when you went to 3, unless you significantly changed the disclosure, no, it's not adequate. It absolutely is not adequate. So that's my attempt to be constructive.
Okay. Thank you. Seichi?
Thank you. Japanese Analyst Association invited the staff of the Accounting Standards Board of Japan and had the 1.5 hour study meeting in middle of February about this exposure draft. 67 chartered members attended this study session, and we sent a questionnaire to them, and 63% of them responded. And we have a good news for you, for the staff, that 93% of the respondents supported the idea of increasing the category. They think that the increased categories will make things complex, but we are living in the very complex world in the first place, so maybe we need one more category to account for this complex world. And also they have the empathy that this new category is required in order to pass the coming insurance exposure draft. Thank you.
So, Osmond, did you want to come in?
I think I put my card down because I was agreeing with what Robert was saying. Essentially, I think that one of the attractions of IFRS 9 compared to IAS 39 is it's a simplification. Without going too simplistic and kind of losing information quality. I also agree with some of the points that are raised in the alternative view about, it had a very clever phrase about a distinction without a difference. So it's talking about the boundary between buy and hold to sell and actually the occasional sales. And I just wonder how that's going to work as well. So, and I understand that some banks that have kind of fed back to you, they're saying, well, we interpret the existing IFRS 9 in a way that would allow us to have occasional sales anyway. I think my overall point is that the simplification was a big step forward. And I think the amortized cost value information is extremely relevant when you're holding to maturity, and the fair value is relevant when you're not. And whether you're holding some to maturity or not, basically, it's a moving portfolio, and the fair value is the relevant information.
My committee wasn't agreed on this, so I don't think we'll be doing a formal response. So I should put the other side. I mean, the insurance analyst on the committee is very much in favour of this, but along some lines which we've touched on before, which is that it just makes insurance companies so difficult to analyse or, difficult to persuade people to invest in if you've got stuff jumping about. She believes that the economic reality is that the matching's fine, and so to have split off have a fair value movement for an asset go through the P&L, and you know, when it's really being matched by the change of the liabilities, and isn't she thinks that's not an economic, a reflection of the economic reality. And the other concern is that, you know, how is this working with Solvency II and other standards? So there's that sort of, you know, that just I just wanted to be, fair to say that those are real, very real concerns. And the closer you get to the sector, obviously, the bigger they are.
Sorry, can I ask Jane a question? You said that you don't think you're going to respond if you can't agree on the answer. I think it would be much
But we can't, well, I suppose we can't, for three reasons. One is you're presenting it as something minor. We want to get the whole thing through. You know, it's slightly IFRS 9 fatigue, and, you know, let's move on. It's partly because we don't have I don't know how to write a draft response, which was a really genuine consensus, including some exactly how you would draw the line if you're going to stick to what Robert and I was saying on, you know, in a perfect world, you'd just stick to the two categories. So that's the sort, you know.
I mean, it's much more valuable to us if groups aren't able to reach a consensus that they actually tell us that and explain why they can't and what the opposing views are. So I'd encourage you to actually send us a response if you can. Don't feel you have to send a consensus response.
And I think particularly if your responses, if your internal discussions are grouped and the groupings like that, so the insurance analyst feeling one thing and everybody else feeling something different, I think that's probably quite useful input to understand from our side.
You are ultimately saying we've got a bunch of people that are going to hold to maturity. We've got a bunch of people who, a bunch of things that are really trading, and then we've got a bunch in the middle that will be anything you want. And you know, it really smells like all you've done is you've just simplified 39 to make three messy categories instead of. And we were talking just from the break. We were talking about a business model, but. You know, this third category means that the companies aren't actually having to belly up to one business model. They're saying we can change business. I know. Hang on. You're going to say they're robust. We put in robust guards so that it won't change. But the problem is, when we went through 39 all those years ago, we actually, that was the user's concern. Are they robust? The staff and the board members at the time were able to put hand on heart and say, yes, we're sure they are. And the reality was they were nowhere near adequate. So I don't see how this is different this time. We haven't fixed the fundamental problem of 39 in the first place. We're sliding to too complex and too fuzzy.
Okay, so the fuzziness is the fundamental problem you're talking about there. I mean, I think, and Osman touched on this a little bit when you were talking about the issues that banks had, and the fact that what certain banks had done anyway is that they had looked at this problem they had with assets where they were most likely holding to collect but might sell from time to time, and they were shoehorning that into amortized cost. And I think this was the problem that was created by having these two polar opposites, was that you ended up having to pick, and because you were having to pick between just those two, you weren't necessarily getting the best answer that you could.
You know, if I had to choose two categories, I'd say, fine. The full amortized cost is gone. If the bank industry wants it, then the reality is you're always going to consider potentially doing some sales. So as an industry, you get two categories, pick which two you want, but you're not getting three. And that's how I would resolve the problem.
Leona and Barbara, I don't know who wants to come in first.
I just wanted to respond to the AFS comment. And I think when you look at the exposure drop, it's easy to think we've just reintroduced AFS. So we're back to available for sale, and that's all this is. But this is quite different from what AFS is today. So if you think about IAS 39, available for sale is the residual category. So, you know, if you don't meet the requirements of any of the other categories, just stick it in there because that's, you know, whereas, and that has brought along all the problems we had with impairment and, you know, when do you recycle and when do you not recycle and all of those problems we had with IAS 39. What this fair value OCI category is doing is it is defined. So you've got a defined business model. And your business model, similar to an amortized cost business model, is a matter of fact. So it's, you know, there's evidence for why or how you manage assets on both these levels. So you do collect the contractual cash flows, but you are also selling quite actively out of this portfolio, which is different to the amortized cost portfolio where opportunistic sales and sales for credit reasons are happening, and that's completely fine. The other thing about this category is, because it's not the residual category, you know, it's quite narrowly defined into what can go in there. So if you've got a portfolio where you say, well, I don't know what I'm going to do with the assets, I haven't made up my mind yet what I'm going to do, I have this portfolio of assets, they won't be able to go in here because you can't prove that you're going to hold and sell at the same time. So that could go into fair value P&L in any case. So fair value P&L is the residual category. It's the catch-all. So if you don't meet this or amortized cost, you will go to fair value P&L.
The reason I am so skeptical is because that same sort of conversation, that same sort of, look, don't worry, they're not going to be able to move between one of the four categories. It will happen, yeah, theoretically it could happen, but only very rarely. And then all of a sudden, that little hole, they drove a truck through it. I repeat what I'm saying. I believe those board members and those staff members that believe that you've got robust barriers, I believe you believe it. I suggest strongly you go back, look at history, and tell us, you know, their business models change. Companies are in the business of when circumstances change, they will change their business model. And what's going to happen is, sometime in the future, those institutions that find a competitive advantage in reporting their results, if they find a competitive advantage to change their business model, they will do what they need to do to make the requirement they change the business model. And it's going to happen. And it will, by the way, when they change the business model, by miraculously, the numbers they're going to present, whatever the change in market, will be much better than if they hadn't changed their business model. That is what we're setting ourselves up for. A change of business model opportunistically to meet...
The potential difference, though, is that under an OCI, fair value OCI, you always had the fair value information. So you always knew what was happening. Under amortized cost, when they do that, you don't actually have that information available. Barbara?
helping or to add to your robust barrier to question or not question, or the other criteria I think that makes this more robust, you can tell me if you agree, is that we are strict on the instruments that can be in these categories. So the cash flows, and I understand that there is discussion about how to interpret this, but we're strict on, you can't just have any instrument in here. That's one thing I wanted to ask you, but I have two questions for you. That was one, do you think that's helpful? And the other one is, you had mentioned if we had to pick two categories to kind of get rid of amortized cost. And is that because you don't think amortized cost gives useful information? And if so, why not?
So on the first comment, I reluctantly have to agree that on the face of it, you do seem to have more robust than last time. But the problem is we thought we really had robust last time. We were proven dead wrong. So I'm a little gun shy to say that we've got it robust this time. So at one level, I actually think that there is an amortized cost model for banks. I really do think that some institutions substantially do keep their assets or their let's talk about loans, keep the loans until maturity, and they're expecting to get the interest. And I actually, just for the fun of it, I'll present that in a fair value context. They should be measured at fair value, but the question is there a market? And the fact that they're not trading it means that they're not getting, it's supposed to be too willing and knowledgeable, and they're not trading it because they're not getting a willing purchaser on the other side. Philippe, who isn't here, pointed out that part of the reason they don't trade it is because what do they do with the cash that they get in the first place in the context of European banks? And that's part of the calculation. So if you take in all the pieces, the reason they're not trading it is because they're just not getting the price they should. And I think that in that particular environment, when there is no market, they're effectively are showing us that they're not getting a willing buyer on the other side. Discounted cash flow seems like a perfectly reasonable level three analysis, perfectly reasonable to do. And then to our earlier comment about, we talked about realization and valuation changes going to OCI. Sounds to me like realization, fair value changes to OCI. What's the problem?
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Jed?
Yeah, I think I have ended up getting comfortable with this, the third category, and I think in part because it does stack up with the other times you've used OCI. Obviously, there's the insurance argument, the changes in the discount rate are going through OCI on the insurance liability. You've got it backed by similar assets to these that you are trading to an extent in a portfolio. The mirror change in the discount rate should generate a loss versus a gain or a gain versus a loss, and putting them through both through OCI makes a certain amount of sense. To an extent, pensions are insurance-type obligations to an extent, and the gains and losses of the change in the discount rate in the assets, assuming they're hedged and run, go through OCI. Why shouldn't this be any different? If I had come back to the point about long-term obligations for things like decommissioning and things, which currently changes in the discount rate go through finance charge rationally, probably those should go through OCI. If you're building up an account of government bonds and things to fund your decommissioning obligation, arguably those would fall into this. Well, at the moment, presumably someone would put it into fair value, so it would offset the discount on the moves in the discount rates on the decommissioning liability. Well, if both were going through OCI, then both would go through OCI and they'd net again. So it's about thinking about where you've got an appropriate hedge and you just don't want economically similar numbers, one to go through the P&L and the other one to go through OCI.
Okay. Jane, did you want to come back in?
One of the underlying concerns is it looks like it's an opportunity for smoothing, and actually the insurance analyst on the committee said, you know, she sort of wanted them to have an opportunity to smooth because it makes the companies look less valuable. If they're holding them to meet liabilities, you know, cash outflows, then it really does look as though it could be amortized cost. It's partly that if we're allowed to, you know, plump for an amortized cost model on this, and Robert's just done it so I can, then maybe that's what you should do, and then you'd have the fair value in a note, as you do with loans and other things, which we definitely want both sets of information. The interesting thing, as you say, is which creates the bridge problem that was referring to earlier, is do we really want them both in the primary statements? So maybe you accept amortized costs, but I think part of the problem is that the discount rates for the liabilities are market driven. So, you know, what's going to happen on that? You know, there's in the UK there's some sort of DWP possible review of pensions accounting, or at least from a regulatory point of view, that would do some smoothing on that. So, in the end, you've probably got to decide for the insurers, is it being driven towards a full fair value model or not? In which case, you know, you get back to them, you wouldn't need the bridge, and you don't create some false volatility. But I don't know. On a cash flow basis, they ought to be holding them to collect the cash to meet the liabilities. And maybe on a portfolio, you've got some stuff moving in and out, but generically, that's what they're doing. And so, you know, why is it? Yeah. Why are they so worried about volatile earnings on that basis, really?
Peter?
I need to ask a question because I really don't understand the problem, really. Mm. If they don't use this new method, will they use amortized cost instead?
Who are we talking about? Who's they?
Yeah.
Insurance, or are we talking about?
Probably.
I think they feel they won't be able to qualify for using amortized cost.
Okay.
So they're worried about fair value.
I think if we're talking simply about the insurers in this context, we feel quite strongly that the liability on an insurer's balance sheet because of the all the moving parts, current value best represents it. And so you have the issue that if they then did qualify for amortized cost, they've got a mismatch before they start. So I think that's if we're talking about insurers. If we're talking broader about other users, or other preparers have a broader concern that there are some assets that don't quite fit into either category, and because the categories are so far apart, so polarized, they feel that something in between might make sense for them in that space.
Because if you have a company that uses amortized cost, and from time to time, when they feel for it, sell the asset and realize a gain, you cannot see that gain. To me, that is not a pleasant situation. If I can see the revaluation through OCI and see if they sell the asset, I can also see the recirculation up in the income statement. I get information that I don't get if they have amortized cost.
Okay, I think I'm going to stop it there, so because you've still got one additional question, haven't you?
Yes. So the next part of the question is of the agenda paper is around transition. So what the exposure draft does, it first of all proposes that entities should be able to only early apply their own credit requirements. So once IFRS 9, the whole standard, including general hedge accounting and impairment, is finalized, entities should be able to only apply their own credit requirements early without having to early adopt the whole of IFRS 9. So that would mean they don't have to wait to have done the whole of the impairment implementation process before they get the benefit of using their own credit requirements to present those changes in OCI. And along with that, the ED is also proposing that once IFRS 9 is finalized, entities won't be able to cherry pick which phase of IFRS 9 they're going to implement and whether they're only going to implement one phase. So if you want to early adopt IFRS 9, you would have to apply the whole standard, apart from, you know, their own credit requirements. So the questions we have on that is on page 5 of the agenda paper. So the question 3 just asks whether you agree that if an entity chooses to apply IFRS 9 early after the completed version is issued, whether it should be the completed version, so all the phases of it, or should they still be able to only apply, let's say, the assets or liabilities phase without doing impairment and hedge accounting. And then the last question is around the own credit requirements and whether you agree with the proposal to be able to apply only the own credit requirements early without having to adopt the whole standard early.
Awesome.
Okay, thanks. I think in answer to the question 3 about adoption of IFRS 9, I think it makes a lot of sense to have some kind of consistency. And I think, yes, you know, you shouldn't be able to pick and choose which parts of the standard you apply. I think if you're applying a standard, you apply all of it. And I think it would help for that to be in place. I think picking and choosing would kind of undermine comparability across entities. I think on the second point, I guess as an aside, the IFRS 9 proposal with regard to own credit is a second best solution, but if that's where we are, then certainly yes, you should be able to apply it. You'll be well aware of the problem that we have in Europe, where IFRS 9 is not set to be endorsed for some time, and you know it's a shame that there seems to be resistance from the ISB to include this proposal in IS 39 more quickly. But you know, at the same time, I think probably every analyst knows to kind of ignore that impact in the P&L anyway. So.
Any other issues on this one? Excellent, then I think we are finished.
Can I make another comment, please? Yes. In the survey that I have mentioned earlier, we asked this question, and here is another good news. 90% of the respondents supported this question 3. Because this would be good for comparability. For the question number 4, 62% of them supported this because they think this is an important thing, therefore could be early application could be allowed. These are the good news, and bad news is that the for the some of the other points, technical points like the modified economic relations, they didn't support them. The survey result will be translated into English and will be sent to you as an appendix of our comment letter. Thank you.
Thanks very much. All right, then I think it just leaves to say thank you very much to everybody for the participation. It was, I think, a very useful session, certainly for me as the first one I've been at, so I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I thoroughly enjoyed the input and insight we got. Do you want to add anything before we close the session?
This closes the public.
Then we'll close the public session, and what we're going to do is close the public session, and then we need a few minutes just to set everything up, so we'll have about a 5-minute break set, just to get everything done. Thanks very much.
Thank you.